Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 25. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we get started, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who have very generously pledged to support this podcast. A huge thank you to Andy, Joanna, Christina, Sharon, Jenny, Julie, and Noel. Thank you, Zon, Raluca, Dawn, Daniel, Leslie, Katie, Jenny G, Sarah, and Shah. A big thank you to Beth, Carol, Caroline, Sally, Haynes, Stephanie, Stacey, Callan and Marcus. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family before the end of March and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. This month's prize is a $50 gift card to ColouringTudorHistory.com, home to Colouring History, Tudor Queens and Consorts, a lavishly illustrated colouring book for grown-ups, and a range of fabulous Tudor-inspired gifts, designed and illustrated by the very talented Catherine Holman. Thank you, Catherine, for donating this wonderful gift. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about two extraordinary discoveries that have recently been made at Sudeley Castle are Lisa Westcott-Wilkins and Stephen Terode. As co-founder and managing director at Dig Ventures, Lisa has found the perfect place to combine archaeology with over 20 years of professional experience in communications, finance and journalism, including several years as editor of Current Archaeology magazine. With a master's degree in archaeology from UCL and a prestigious Clough Fellowship under her belt, she now focuses her energy wrangling field archaeologists and harnessing brilliant creative sector innovations for Dig Ventures. She is an international speaker on crowdfunding for the creative and cultural sectors and leads on the consultancy aspect of Dig Ventures' work. She's responsible for the Americanisms, absurdly strong site coffee and early morning Dig Ventures dance parties. Stephen Terode trained in horticulture at the Royal Park at Greenwich, followed by 3 years' study at the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew, where he became interested in medieval and early modern gardens and the plants and literature associated with them. Stephen has managed several historic gardens in England and Wales and is now head gardener at Sudeley Castle and Gardens in Gloucestershire, England. He's a fellow of the Linnean Society of London. My conversation with Lisa and Stephen straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales.
Thank you. Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Talking Tudors. Now this is quite an exciting episode because it's the first time that I've actually chatted to two guests. So I'm really, really excited to welcome to Talking Tudors Lisa Westcott-Wilkins, who is the co-founder of Dig Ventures, and Stephen Terode, head gardener at Sudley Castle. So firstly, welcome Lisa. Could you introduce yourself to our listeners, please?
Yes. Hi, good morning. Good morning. Hello, everyone at Talking Tudors. my name is Lisa Westcott-Wilkins. I am an archaeologist and one of the co-founders of Dig Ventures. We're based in the UK, and we specialize in basically creating opportunities for anyone who's interested to be a part of the extremely exciting archaeology projects that we do.
Oh, that does sound very exciting. And Stephen, could you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes, of course. My name's Stephen Terode. I'm currently the head gardener at Sudley Castle and Gardens. I've been here now for, I think, about 4 years, but I've managed a number of gardens in England during the past however many years it is. Most of the gardens I've managed have been historic, actually a lot of them dating from the Victorian and Edwardian eras, but all of them are essentially formal gardens. Many of them have arts and crafts features, and my particular interest really is in medieval and Tudor gardening in England. So actually it's really wonderful to be at Sudley because we have this fantastic lost Tudor garden.
Yeah, that is absolutely fantastic. Now, Sudley Castle is one of my favourite historic houses, I have to admit. I've visited many, but that one has a particular wonderful atmosphere, I think. Now, apart from the intriguing, obviously, historical connections, I think there's quite a sense of timelessness there that's it's kind of difficult to describe, I suppose. What is it that you love about Sudley, Lisa?
Gosh, it's incredible. You know, my first visit was when Stephen had first called us and invited us to come along. And what I love about the place, beyond, you know, the sort of the architecture and the atmosphere and the buildings and the gardens, is actually Lady Ashcombe's connection to Sudley. Right. She is sort of this living, breathing reminder that Sudley has always been someone's home. So when I, you know, my job is there to look at the science of things and to think about how Sudley was in the past and what it meant to the people living there, particularly the period that we're investigating. But I really loved, you know, having chats with her and understanding how it lives and breathes still as a family home.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that does make it very special. So what about you, Stephen? Why is it a special place for you?
Well, actually, I knew of Sudley quite a long time before I finally came to work here. And I think what interested me originally was its Tudor history.
Yeah.
And when I eventually came here, I rather loved the gardens because my particular liking is for formal gardens, but also those which have a sort of romantic and theatrical character to them. And Sudley certainly does that. And in fact, you know, when you get to know Sudley, perhaps even when you don't know it particularly well, you almost feel history here. You know, you can look out of windows and touch stones that you know people like Catherine Parr looked out of the windows, or she walked along the same sorts of paths and that sort of thing. Yeah. So you almost feel history. There's a very thin veil, really, between present history here.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too. So, Lisa, traces of two extraordinary Tudor treasures have recently been uncovered at Sudley. The remains of a banqueting house built for Elizabeth I and traces of an original Tudor garden. I would absolutely love to hear more about these amazing discoveries. How did they come about and why do you feel it's important that we learn more about them?
Well, it's utterly Stephen's fault, I have to say.
Your fault, Stephen, I see.
As he said, you know, Stephen's very interested in gardens of this period. And, you know, as such, had, I think, taken it on as a personal project to begin to investigate this field of lumps and bumps in the areas surrounding Sudley that at the moment is used for grazing for horses. And Stephen had been a part of getting some geophysics and topographic survey done on this field prior to us arriving and having it studied by a very knowledgeable local historian. And the results of these early non-invasive techniques showed very clearly a geometric outline underneath the field, which is consistent with what you might expect from a Tudor garden. So you know, it very much came to light because of Stephen's sleuthing and his passion for gardens of this period, you know, leading him to want to have this early work done. So, you know, he then had seen some of our other work on another site online and rang us up and said, you know, I like what you guys do. Would you be interested in having a look at Sudeley? And, you know, that's an incredible offer to receive, obviously. So we were very excited. And, you know, I love a good mystery. And I also love thinking about how rare this opportunity is and how it would add to the story of a place like Sudeley, which has already got so much incredible history to offer. And, you know, I think what's important about learning more about these gardens is it puts historical events that we have documentary evidence of, it puts them really in people's hands to be able to go and investigate the actual places where the events happened. And, you know, normally the sites that I work on are much older than this. Actually, we work a lot in prehistory or in the Anglo-Saxon period. And, you know, certainly with prehistory, it's impossible to put a name with, you know, really with a place in this way. And so, you know, this is very tangible, and it's been very different for me to work on a site where we have so much documentary evidence. Like Stephen said, we know that Catherine Parr would have looked upon, you know, this garden. We know that Elizabeth would have walked its paths, and it's really tantalizing to try and think about, you know, once we get down to the levels there, will we find any material culture? You know, will we find things that belong to the people in the party, you know, as they were reveling? Did they perhaps lose a few coins type thing? But we do have the opportunity to add hugely tangible evidence to the story of Sudeley and the story of this exciting period in the history of Britain.
Gosh, that is exciting. And I really do hope you find some things when you start digging. That's amazing. So,
me too.
Yeah, fingers crossed. So, Stephen, I absolutely love the gardens at Sudeley Castle. I think they're truly a highlight of any visit. I would love it if you could talk to us a little bit about the original Tudor gardens at Sudeley. What did they look like and what big Tudor names would have wandered through them?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say is that essentially we don't know what the Tudor gardens looked like.
Oh,
because, of course, there are no records, which is a hindrance. And this is why it's actually quite important that we do this archaeology, because
definitely.
That will help us out what the gardens really were like. What we do know is, roughly speaking, what the plan looked like, but we don't know what the were above ground, and we may find some evidence in the dig later this year that will give us some clues as to perhaps the form that the garden took above ground. But if we start from the castle itself, if we imagine that we're standing with our backs against the castle, the formal gardens that we're interested in were laid out in front of, in front of really means in this case to the east of the principal private apartments, so the banquet, what we call the banqueting hall. And closest to the castle, we have essentially two compartments, or quarters, if you like, which on the right-hand one, the southernmost one, was discovered as a garden in the 19th century, in fact, when Emma Dent and her husband lived here. And that then was, a new garden was created using the original footprint. So the disposition of the paths and beds is pretty much as per the garden that was found in the 19th century, which must have predated the middle of the 17th century, because of course the whole place was a ruin after the civil war in the 17th century. So we know there was no formal gardening taking place here after, say, the mid 17th century. So that is what we currently call the Queen's Garden, and that is presently a rose garden. But if you imagine that quarter divided by cruciform paths with a large fountain basin in the middle, and each of the quarters that are formed by those cruciform paths are divided into small beds, more or less triangular shape, because they're made in the corners of the lawns, with a central circular bed. To the left of that, or to the north, if you like, there is no garden quarter. That space, which in other places might have been taken up by another garden, is in this case taken up by the church. It's the Church of St. Mary, which has medieval origins. And that was part of the castle complex. We know that was joined to the castle by a walkway, which Catherine Parr used probably daily on her way to church. Those areas are existing, and visitors coming to the castle will see those if they come here today. But looking further away from that, we have the site which we're interested in an archaeological context. So essentially, leading directly away from the Queen's Garden,
yes,
we have a slightly larger site. By slightly larger, I probably mean twice as large as the current Queen's Garden. And that itself, from what we can tell on the LIDAR results, is divided more or less into four large compartments. Again, there appear to be cruciform paths. And each of those compartments is apparently further divided into about four by more paths. The whole of that is basically a square. On the two farthest corners of that square, there are two enigmatic mounds, one of which we had a look at late last year. And that mound may well either be the site of a pavilion or banqueting house.
Right.
And it's possible that it was a viewing mound, but we don't know yet. Hopefully we'll get some answers to that later this year.
Mm.
And opposing that, there's another mound of a slightly different shape, which again may have had a purpose in relation to the garden as some sort of viewing platform or some platform on which there was another building. And then to the north of that, there is an even more enigmatic area, roughly the same size, but we really don't know what that is. There are various undulations in the land. It's possible that they may be degraded ponds. We don't know, but it would be consistent with the Tudor garden for there to have been some sort of water feature here. So again, that may be what was going on there, but that's much less distinct on the LIDAR results.
Right.
As far as above ground's concerned, we can only guess. Most Tudor gardens at the time would have had certain features in common. They always were quite formal, geometrically laid out beds, which I've alluded to in, mm-hmm. in my description so far. Those beds would usually be raised. As time went on in the 16th century, the degree to which the beds were raised, I think, decreases. So we're probably talking here about late Tudor gardens, so probably Elizabethan.
Right.
And by that time, we may have raised beds which are perhaps only 6 inches or so higher than the surrounding soil. And those beds would have been planted with a variety of things, including evergreen plants of varying types. They would have had scented plants, things like carnations, stocks, wallflowers, pinks, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The evergreens may well have included things like rosemary, possibly box, but they didn't really clip box in the Tudor period because they knew that it smells rather horrid if it's clipped.
Right.
So they tended to use box unclipped. Thyme would have been grown. All these sorts of things we know were grown, I think, at Kenilworth Castle.
Mm-hmm.
In the garden has recently been recreated there. There's a very good documentary source which tells us what the Kenilworth garden looked like. And of course, there are books from the period again which tell us what sort of plants would have been grown in gardens. The gardens themselves would have been surrounded probably by some sort of palisaded walkway.
Right.
Yeah. Usually these were covered, and today we would think of them really as trellis.
Mm.
So if you imagine corridors dividing the compartments up, probably supporting roses, vines, possibly honeysuckle, that sort of thing. And then people could walk along these sort of shady walkways and enjoy the gardens. And if it's a hot sunny day, they don't get too sunburned, I suppose. And
absolutely heavenly, doesn't it?
It sounds divine. Yes. I'm picturing it in my mind and I love it.
Of course, there would have been fountains. I mentioned we have one in the middle of the present Queen's Garden. And on the site that we're looking at archaeologically, there is a depression in a site that puts it more or less central to the whole garden or whole formal garden complex. And that may be the site of another fountain. But we don't know yet.
Stephen keeps adding targets for our dig.
Yeah, he's keeping you busy. I can see that.
Yes. We could be there for years.
That sounds good.
Exactly.
Dream job, if you ask me. Well, that sounds absolutely divine. I think I had a smile on my face that whole time that you were describing it, just thinking of walking around there.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, the residents of Sudley would have enjoy those beautiful gardens, I'm sure. Now, just for our listeners, because you mentioned earlier the church, the beautiful church that's there. Now, I'm assuming that most people listening will probably know, but that is the final resting place of Catherine Parr. So just in case anyone out there wasn't aware of that, it's absolutely beautiful church and a beautiful space, I think.
Yeah, and I agree with that. When we were there, we were lucky enough to catch some beautiful weather, and we happened to be in that church at the time, and the way that the stained glass windows are positioned, you know, the sort of sparkles on and the color on the wall sort of hits immediately above her tomb, and it was really magical.
Definitely. That is, yeah, the light coming in is absolutely beautiful. And did you want to add anything else, Stephen, about the gardens at all?
I've probably said enough so far. I think I've given you a good idea.
I think you have. I know, me being greedy, I just want more information all the time. Well, I've read that the garden that you've uncovered at Sudeley is one of perhaps only two in the whole of England where the original paths are hopefully still in place. Now, why are they such rare survivals?
Well, I think in the case of most Tudor gardens, and there are a number which are known archaeologically, but in most cases it's really the earthworks that survive. Very often you find with Tudor gardens raised mounts, which I've already mentioned. The Tudors loved looking down on gardens from above, and also terracing is usually a feature, and it's usually things like the mounts and the terracing which survive. The beds themselves, because they're only raised a small way above the ground, are much more ephemeral. And of course, if the area is reused to make a garden later on, as many have been as part of later garden designs, those bed patterns are very easily lost, or indeed if the area is ploughed. But I suppose because terraces and mounds are much larger, it's much less likely that they're going to become lost, although they may become a little degraded over time.
Right.
And also with Sudeley, because the place was slighted and ruined in the middle of the 17th century, and no one of note lived here for another 2 years, there was no formal gardening taking place here. So the landscape movement, Capability Brown, that sort of thing, really passed Sudeley by. And essentially the garden fell asleep, but under a covering of soil.
Right.
And fortunately, there was no ploughing undertaken on the site, so the outlines of the beds survived, and that means that we can see where the paths were. And if you look at the site from ground level, it's not really very distinct, but we're fortunate in that we have this LIDAR survey which was done, and that shows us where the beds and paths were. And so in most Tudor garden sites, what you find are, as I say, that the terracing, the mounds, and also very often pavilions. If the pavilions are originally made from brick or stone, they do survive, sometimes very well indeed, and sometimes they're still used as houses today. We don't have those, but we're fortunate that we seem to have the layout of the paths. What the surfaces were, at the moment, we don't know. We may get some sort of clue when the dig's happening later this year.
Yeah, I hope so.
I would bet on that, Stephen. I would bet on that.
And I love that. I love that imagery that you use of the garden, you know, falling asleep. I love that. Now, I think it's time to wake it up, though, don't you? So we can all enjoy it again.
Yes. Well, I mean, and from an archaeological perspective, so many of the great discoveries, archaeological discoveries that have captured the imagination of people worldwide are always, there's always an element of chance, you know, the conditions were exactly right, that something was preserved, and, you know, we then end up getting to learn so much more from it. And in a way, that's exactly what's happening here. You know, Stephen said they fell asleep, and in our minds, we've been talking about it almost as though it's a mummy garden, you know, perfectly preserved, almost wrapped up with a bow for us to go in and have a look.
Yeah, definitely. What a great gift. Now, Stephen, I'll give you a break in a moment, but I just wanted to ask, what's a day in the life of Sudeley's head gardener like?
Well, it is rather variable. I usually start work at 8 o'clock in the morning, although usually I'm doing emails and things from home a little bit earlier than that. But the first thing in the morning usually is for me to meet the team, and we sort of catch up and discuss how the previous day has been and what we're intending to achieve today, as it were, and be for a few days in the future. And then as far as the work itself is concerned, it can be anything really. It can involve, in the case of one day, it can involve a meeting or two, sometimes more. Involve some office work. Mm-hmm. I may be interviewing people for jobs or volunteers. I may be doing some guided tours. And a lot of the time I'll be gardening. So the gardening itself can be pruning, weeding, what have you. I tend not to get involved with lawn mowing. Right. But yes, all sorts of things. It's quite variable. No 2 days are the same, really.
You know what? One of the things I really want to do, Stephen, when we're there digging, is to swap jobs. I want you to spend a day in our trenches, and I want to spend a day going around doing your job. Because in some ways, we're always joking with people that they should think about archaeology as just extreme gardening. so dealing with things down rather than up. But I am so curious to spend a day sort of chasing you around and seeing what it's actually like.
Yes, well, why not? Good idea. Well, you'll be here for plenty of time.
That sounds like fun. I like the sound of your job, Stephen. Now, Lisa, let's talk more about the banqueting house built for Elizabeth I's Armada party. What do the historical records tell us about this event and the actual banqueting house structure?
Well, I mean, the event is really well chronicled. You know, we know that she went on progress to celebrate the anniversary of the defeat of the Spanish Armada. Mm-hmm. She and her retinue arrived at Sudeley, which, of course, was incredibly politically important at the time and also very well known to Elizabeth I. And Lord Chandos threw her, you know, an amazing 3-day party. It sounded like quite a big deal. And it nearly, you know, so much so that he nearly bankrupted himself.
Right. Yep. Her parties tend to do that to people, don't they?
Yes. Good lad. But this was not unusual for the time. So, you know, we do know that, you know, these visits by monarchs at the time, you know, you pulled out all the stops. You did this ostentatious display of wealth to, you know, sort of curry favor, but also to visibly show the monarch how important their favor was to you. So we know that much about the party. And I mean, this garden in particular, the banqueting house in particular, we don't have any documentary evidence of. So that's one of the really big challenges of this dig. Mm-hmm. You know, what we did find is evidence to support the fact that there could have been quite a substantial temporary structure on that central mound. We know that there's been some masonry recovered from that field previously, but at this point we don't have anything further to go on. And as Stephen was saying, Kenilworth has a fantastically detailed description of the temporary Tudor garden, but we're not so lucky, I'm afraid, at Sudeley. So basically that we've got it all to play for at this point.
Well, that's exciting. Yeah, you don't know what you're going to discover. That's really cool. Now, when we talk about temporary structures and royal tents, that kind of thing, the Field of Cloth of Gold, of course, immediately kind of springs to mind, because these tents, you know, they weren't like the ones that we might take on the family camping trip today. They were extremely elaborate, portable palaces. Could you tell us more about these temporary structures and how they've furthered our understanding of how the itinerant Tudor court operated?
It's not actually my area of expertise.
Oh, that's okay.
Yes, what we do know, I mean, there is a lot of emerging research right now around these temporary structures and how much how important they would have been to the way the Tudor court operates. And as you know, we're doing quite a lot of reading on this sort of new emerging stuff. So what we do know is like I said, you know, people were pulling out all of the stops back then. You know, what I think the real key is in the word temporary. What we would think of as temporary is not like what they thought of as temporary at all. They pulled out all the stops, and it really was incredibly elaborate. And one of the things I've really fallen in love with about that Tudor period is how committed they were to that pomp. You know, it had absolutely perfect. It had to feel that you had every comfort and beyond when you were traveling. And of course, you know, when I travel now, I go with as few things as possible. Yeah. You know, a tiny bit. If I could manage it. So it's just such a stretch to begin to imagine the amount of resources they had to align to create, not only create the temporary structures, the hosts, but, you know, the belongings that would have been brought with the retinues as well.
Absolutely. And that's an area that I absolutely love reading about. And I spent a lot of time kind of researching their progresses, because I find I find those absolutely amazing, and you know, huge theatrical performances, and just picturing the retinue snaking across the countryside, and you know, and they weren't. We're all about simplifying now, aren't we? Trying to throw things out from our house, and they were kind of the opposite. Take literally everything with you when you travel, and I suppose that those great tents, or you know, as we're calling them, tents, came in handy because there were not many Tudor residences that could house the entire court, only a handful. So I, you know, they were obviously staying in some temporary structures at different points as well. Really fascinating. Love it. Now, Lisa, can you give us an update on the dig and tell us how us Tudor history lovers can get involved?
Sure. My favorite subject. Well, how Tudor enthusiasts can get involved, there are many different ways. I mean, come and dig with us.
That would be so much fun.
Yes. For anyone who does want to come and dig, we're crowdfunding it, actually, to get this first early stage of the research going. Okay. So if you want to come along and dig and be a part of the effort, or you know, receive copies of the site report or any of the other great benefits of supporting the dig, just head on over to our website at digventures.com and you'll see everything right there on the projects page for you. We'll also be broadcasting live from the dig, which really is, you know, we'll be across social media sharing our discoveries as and when they happen. I'm sure you won't be able to shut Stephen and I up, actually, as things are coming up out of the ground. And we're also really fortunate because Philippa Gregory, obviously one of the great sort of Tudor period authors, is very close to the project, and she'll be with us on site now and then, and we will be running a live stream of a talk that she's giving. So there's going to be lots of different opportunities, and I would say the best way for people to stay close to the dig is to register for our newsletter, which you can also do on the website, because we'll be announcing all of the upcoming events and stuff by those means. But equally, just swing by the crowdfunding campaign and see if anything takes your fancy.
Oh, definitely. That sounds so good. And look, it's a 21-hour flight from Sydney to London. But honestly, I'm so tempted. I can't tell you how tempted I am. Hopefully my husband doesn't hear that because I'm always jetting off.
For those of you who are only just hearing about this and might not be able to be involved this year, as you can see, Stephen keeps throwing targets at us. So fingers crossed we won't be done this year. And I think it's very, very likely that you can expect another big dig would be between us and Sudeley in 2020, not least of which because that's the 500-year anniversary of the Field of Cloth of Gold. So who knows, we might be planning a very elaborate traveling court of our own.
That sounds fantastic, and that gives us all time to save our pennies. That's fabulous. Now, I have one more question for the two of you, and this is more because this is a personal interest of mine, so I'm being a bit cheeky here. But have you ever had any, maybe Stephen, you might like to answer this one, have you ever had any spooky experiences at Sudeley Castle? Anything ghosty, any Tudor ghosts coming to say hello?
Well, I haven't personally, but there are a whole host of stories of spooky goings on at Sudeley. I suppose probably more relevant to us, there are tales of a lady in green who is said to be seen here, and some people think that's Catherine Parr. Whether it was or not, I don't know. Who knows? But I suppose the closest I have come to it was one day when I was working in the Queen's Garden with a bunch of my team, and one of them was working a little way distant, and suddenly he called out to me, "Did you hear that?" And I hadn't heard anything. And what he'd heard was a dog running along the path.
Right.
But in fact, there was no dog. And he thought from the sound of its paw prints on the path that it sounded like a medium-sized dog. Now, interestingly, not during the Tudor period, but later on in the 17th century, Sudeley was headquarters for Prince Rupert of the Rhine. Who had a dog, which was a poodle, and the poodle used to go off to battle with him, and in fact you occasionally find engravings of the period which feature the poodle. The poodle was called Boy, and who knows, maybe this dog that my colleague was actually Boy running along the path.
That could have been,
I have to say, I'm absolutely desperate to be haunted. I want to be haunted to bits at Soodley when we're there.
Oh, careful what you ask for, Lisa. That's what
waiting
that's
for
the
it.
Saying, isn't
I
it?
I could be waiting for it.
Oh, love it. Okay, fantastic. Now, I don't know, Lisa, if you've heard any of the other episodes, but I like to end by playing a little game of what I call 10 to go.
Yes.
So they're just kind of 10, you know, fast questions. What I thought I'd do is I'll split it between you so we're nice and even. So 5 each. So are you both ready to play our little game?
I'm ready.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go. So, Lisa, first one for you. What inspires you?
Oh, my God. Everything. It's insane. My team will be laughing if they hear this, but I'm a bit of a magpie. I can take inspiration from anything, and usually it's stuff outside archaeology.
Yeah.
You know, I'm open to all different kinds of creative ideas, and I try to bring as much of that as I can to the archaeological work that we do.
That's fantastic. I love that. And Stephen, what are two items that are on your bucket list? Well, maybe you don't have a bucket list, but now you have to think of one.
Well, you're right. I don't have a bucket list.
Okay.
I don't know, really. I hadn't thought about it. Two items. I suppose, really, what I would put on my bucket list
yes.
are probably things to own, because I love old books.
Oh,
and
yeah.
In fact, I collect Tudor books. So there are some Tudor gardening books that perhaps I would like to own. One of them is Ruralia Commoda, which King Henry VIII had a copy of.
Oh, wow.
Originally, it's a medieval text, but it was later printed. They tend to be quite rare these days and
yeah.
rather expensive. But who knows, if I win the lottery or something,
exactly,
I may take myself a copy of Ruralia Commoda. And the other one, which I would love to have, again, is a book, Paradisian Sol Paradisus Terrestris, which was published in 1629. Again, they tend to be quite rare and quite expensive.
Mm.
But that is a classic gardening book from the Stuart period this time, written by a chap called John Parkinson. But yes, I have a later edition, but the original first edition of 1629 would be very nice to have.
Oh, yes, I love old books. I know, they're just absolutely magnificent. Now, Lisa, what when you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
A spy. And then I wanted to be a veterinarian.
Okay.
And then I wanted to be an archaeologist.
Oh, so well, that's pretty good. Top three. That's excellent. And Stephen, what about you?
My initial interest really was in wildlife and animals. So I think very early on I wanted to be involved in some way with natural history conservation.
Okay.
And that morphed really into teaching biology, but eventually I became a gardener because I grew up in London and it was easier to be involved with natural history by gardening than it was to be involved with wildlife living in London.
Yeah, yeah, sounds good.
Besides the urban foxes, of course.
Exactly, yes.
That's right. All right. Lisa, one for you. If you had a time machine and you could travel back to witness one moment in Tudor history, what would it be?
Oh, everyone always asks archaeologists this kind of questions. It's totally impossible for me to answer one moment in Tudor history. I don't know. You know, I think it would have to be. There's so many.
I know.
But I think it would have to be Dudley proposing to Elizabeth I and her turning him down like that.
Oh, yes. That would be good.
Wouldn't
to want
to see that.
Definitely. Definitely. Now, Stephen, easy one for you. What was the last movie that you watched?
Well, it's funny enough, it's not that easy.
It's not that.
I can't remember. I tend not to listen to watch very many. It would probably have been a Tudor one. Probably about Queen Elizabeth I or Lady Jane Grey, something like that. But
I
just can't remember, so long ago.
That's okay. Don't worry. All good. Let's see. What can we ask Lisa? Lisa, what's something you love about living in England?
Pubs.
Yeah,
I know it's the wrong answer, but we don't have pub culture in the States.
No,
and one of the things I love about it is that it's so convivial, you know, and it's a great sort of third space in your life. We all have work. We all have home. Well, if we're lucky, we have work and we have home. But what's great is to have that third space where you can go that feels very much a part of your life and is very community orientated. And moving around as much as we do because of work and everything else, as archaeologists, that's a place that's always constant. You can always go into a pub anywhere that you are and find that same kind of relaxation and community spirit. And I love that about living here.
Yeah, that's so true. You can't beat an English pub. That's definitely true. Stephen, what was a favourite childhood book of yours?
Oh, probably. Well, I don't know that there was a specific favourite childhood book, mm-hmm. but I did have quite a collection of books about birds.
About
birds, because that was one bit of wildlife that I could indulge in London. So, yes, it would have been one or other of my bird identification books, I'm sure.
Excellent, thank you. Lisa, what was the last thing you bought?
That's a really fun question. Let's see. Where was I?
Where were you?
So the last thing that I bought actually were three books. You're going to love this story.
Love it.
More books.
Good.
Three books about Ötzi, you know, the ice mummy in Italy. Because I've just returned back from a little holiday where we traveled from Vienna by train down through the Dolomites to go and actually see the ice mummy. So we bought three books in the museum shop, and that's the last thing I bought.
That's fantastic. I love that it's books. More books. Can never have enough
more
of them.
Yes. The house teething with them.
Yeah, I know. Oh, my goodness. I know. I have the exact same issue. Stephen, what was your first paid job?
It was gardening.
My
entry into gardening was as an apprentice in the Royal Park at Greenwich, and that was my first paid job.
Fantastic. Yeah. That sounds good. And it is time for our Tudor takeaway. Now, at the end, we like to end with something that our listeners can go off and explore. Might be a website, a book, a song, a video. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us? Either of you, actually, Lisa or Steve.
Yeah, I know. I suppose I do, and it's really not going to be fair to your Australian listeners or others who are not in a position to come here.
That's all right. We're tough. Don't worry. We're tough. It's all right. Okay. We're good.
Well, what I would say is, I mean, as an archaeologist, I've never had a Tudor site previously in my career to Sudeley. Mm. So ever since Stephen, first called us, it's been a real voyage of discovery for me, not only in terms of the specific historical aspects, but equally learning about the physical aspects of these sites. So, we visited several of them now, and each one opens my eyes in a really different way and helps me begin to understand, the significance of our work and what to expect at Sudeley. So my Tudor takeaway is go to these places, try to find a quiet moment when you're there if you can. They're often just overrun with visitors. They're incredibly popular places, Tudor sites, because they are so evocative and they feel so close to us because we know so much about them from the documentary sources. But go to these places and let yourself really experience them and imagine what they would have been like back in the day.
Yeah, I completely and utterly agree with you. That's one of my favorite things to do, is just to walk around these amazing buildings and just absorb all that history and all the atmosphere. It's absolutely fantastic. Stephen, did you want to add anything?
Well, yes. I'm scratching my head, really, because I've got three books, really, which I would count as my Tudor takeaway.
Yeah.
We do have an expert in Tudor and Stuart houses and gardens, Dr. Paula Henderson, who's been advising us on this project. She lives locally, and she produced a wonderful book, which was published in 2005, called The Tudor House and Garden. And unfortunately, it's no longer in print, though secondhand are available. They are actually quite expensive to buy. But that is a mine of information about Tudor gardens and houses. Alongside that, there's a much more available publication produced about the Elizabethan garden at Kenilworth Castle, written by Anna Key and John Watkins. Again, that is a mine of information, and that includes a transcript of the Langham letter, which describes Kenilworth garden as it was in its heyday.
Fascinating.
But last year there was another wonderful book on Tudor and Stuart gardens produced, which is called Gardens and Gardening in Early Modern England and Wales, 1560 to 1660, written by Jill Francis. And that was published last year. So that's bang up to date with research in how Tudor gardens were laid out and the plants that were used in them. And that, of course, is still in print. So probably that would be top of my list at the moment, because that one is easy to get hold of.
Fantastic. Well, my TBR list just got a lot longer. Thank you very much, Stephen. I love it. All right. Well, this has been an absolute pleasure talking to you both. It's such an exciting project, and I will be one of those people following online and looking to see what all the updates. So thank you both very much for talking Tutors with me.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tutors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetutortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tutors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.